Good morning. Many of you know that we have five children, two of which are elementary school boys. One of the things we figured out about having so many kids is that shoes become a problem. So I have this suspicion that my boys go to school and take their shoes off and just beat them against the wall and stab them with objects because they come home. And it's like, how could this happen just from wearing your shoes? But 10-year-old boys are fairly hard on their shoes. And this used to be a problem for us as a family until we discovered three little words, REI. REI is a sports company, a sports store that has discovered this idea that consumers like us like to have satisfaction guaranteed. We want to know when we buy something that's going to last a certain length of time. So they tell you that you can return anything you buy there whenever you want. So we can go and buy shoes, and if they are in tatters after a week, we can bring them back and say, these shoes didn't last, and we get a new pair of shoes. If they're in tatters after a year, we could bring them back. Now, you know, you have to kind of figure, well, shoes have a certain lifespan, and boys are roughing them and all that, but this idea that satisfaction is guaranteed when you buy something at REI is so compelling, especially when you have 10-year-old boy destroying shoes. But what do you do when satisfaction isn't guaranteed? What do you do when you're not exactly sure how the effort you spend or the time you invest or the money that you spend is going to be used well or pay off or give results? What do you do in your classes? How do you focus on classes when you're not even sure you're in the right major, college students? How do you work hard at your job when you're not even sure you like your job, the rest of us? How do you work hard in your family? How do you make decisions as a parent when you don't know whether those decisions are good decisions until decades down the road? How do you put in effort without knowing what the results are going to be? This morning, we're starting a new series called Between the Times. It's a study going through the book of 1 and 2 Thessalonians. Scott Grant and I will be team teaching this series a little bit differently than we've done in the past. We're going to be taking 1 and 2 weeks, kind of tag teaming back and forth, so that'll be a new experience. The series will last us roughly through the beginning of summer. We'll take some breaks for things like Easter and Beautiful Day. But I'm excited about this series because these two books in particular have more detail about the return of Jesus in the end times than most of the books in the New Testament. That's one of their major themes. But on the other hand, they also refer back to this young church who has a recently discovered faith in Jesus Christ and his death and resurrection. And so there's this kind of sense that these letters were written to a new community that is on one hand looking forward to something significant, but is on the other hand looking back to something significant. And in the midst of that, they have to figure out, well, what do we do now? Based on what's happened and based on what's to come, how do we live between these two major events? And that's the call for all of us if we have faith in Jesus. I'm excited to study these letters together for us as PVC because we've been asking these types of questions. How do we live uniquely here in the 21st century in Silicon Valley? What does it mean for us to impact our local communities now? How do we take this faith in a Jesus of 2,000 years ago and a Jesus to come and Jesus here, and how do we wrap all that up and live lives of following him? We want to live well between the times. To kick off this series, we're actually going to start before the books of 1 and 2 Thessalonians. We'll go back to the story in Acts chapter 17 of how those churches were founded. We're going to see how this city in ancient Macedonia, modern-day Greece, of Thessalonica, had some visitors come and plant a church. But what we're going to notice about this story is that the efforts of the people that planted this church were very uncertain. They got there, they preached a message, they met with some acceptance, some opposition, but in the end they left without really knowing whether what they had done, whether the time and energy they had spent would pay off. This church had uncertain beginnings. And as we hear about the uncertain beginnings of this church, we're going to think about the uncertain things in our own lives. We're going to think about similar efforts that we've been a part of. And we're going to ask the question, what does it look like to be faithful? How do we maintain a sense of faithfulness to God when we don't know how all of those things will play out? How do we face situations when we don't know what will come of our efforts? How do we trust God with uncertain beginnings? I think this story is going to help us. It begins in Acts chapter 17. I'm going to start off by reading verse 1. Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Now we got to kind of catch ourselves up. We're jumping into the middle of a story here in Acts. We got to figure out where we are. The they here refers to Paul and his companions. Paul used to be a Jewish leader. He was one of the foremost people in trying to destroy the early church, until Jesus himself appeared to him and said, "Hey, stop it. Stop persecuting me and follow me." So in a day, Paul turned his life around and became as passionate about building the church as he was about destroying the church. But he's kind of one of those all-in wild guys, and so his first couple efforts were near disastrous. So the apostle said, you got to go off, and you got to kind of grow up a little bit in Jesus. So he went off for about a dozen years, spent some time maturing in faith, and ended up settling in a city called Antioch. From there, the leaders of that church sent out him and another gentleman named Barnabas to go preach this message of Jesus to the surrounding area. That was called the first missionary journey of Paul. So Paul and Barnabas did that, and they finished. Then they decided, hey, we should go back and visit those churches. But Paul and Barnabas had a bit of a disagreement about how that should play out. So they separated ways, and Paul chose Silas and Timothy to go with him on this new journey, which is what we see before us right now. They wandered around for a bit. They ended up not really visiting a lot of the churches that they thought they would visit. And then God spoke to them. Paul received this vision of a man from Macedonia saying, "Come here and help us." And that was the direction they were waiting for. So they immediately went up north to the region of Macedonia, and they started preaching the gospel there. They started in the city of Philippi. They got there, they preached about Jesus, they were arrested, they were beaten, they were thrown in jail, and then there was this huge earthquake, the jail was split open, the jailer confessed and proclaimed faith in Jesus. The city officials repented and said, "We didn't know you were Roman citizens," and they sent them off with a safety guarantee. God worked in miraculous ways. And that brings us back up to where we are now. Acts 17, chapter 1. They went through these two other cities, Amphipolis and Apollonia, and they got to Thessalonica. That's the second missionary journey. There was a synagogue when they arrived in this city, and they started preaching there. Here's verses 2 and 3 that summarize that. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus, whom I proclaim to you, is the Christ." Just like Paul did pretty much everywhere he went, he goes into the synagogue and he preaches to the Jews about Jesus. He begins with the Old Testament scriptures, the scriptures that they had, and he shows them how they point to Jesus. Now, what I want us to notice is the simplicity of his message. He's simply telling them who Jesus is. And he's pointing out that from their Old Testament scriptures, they had this picture of a Messiah. They knew that life was broken. They knew that things didn't work the way they were meant to work. And they knew that God wanted to fix that for them. And he had planned to send somebody to bring in a new kind of kingdom, to bring in the kind of life they were meant to live. They knew that they were waiting for a Messiah. And they'd heard about this guy, Jesus. And they'd heard that he walked around, and he walked around Jerusalem, and some people liked him and some people didn't. They'd heard that he was executed. They'd heard that some people thought he might have risen from the dead. Some people claimed to have seen him. But that's about all they knew. So what Paul was trying to do is he's trying to say, this picture of the Messiah that you already know about lines up with Jesus. This Jesus whom I proclaim to you is the Christ. He was just trying to help them to see, because they had a hard time seeing that those pictures matched. Some of you know that I had long hair in college, past my shoulders. I used to play on the worship team up here on this stage. I played bass, and I was kind of the long-haired bass player guy. And a lot of people knew me that way. So here I was. I was Paul Taylor, the long-haired bass player guy. But then at some point, I cut my hair. And for the first few days after I cut my hair in college, I had this surreal experience where I would walk around campus and walk right past people I knew really well, and they just wouldn't even see me. There'd be no recognition at all, because I was Paul Taylor, the long-haired bass player guy, and this short-haired guy walking by couldn't have been that guy, right? But, you know, we understand that hair can be cut, so people figured it out pretty quickly, and they realized that these pictures actually matched up, that who they thought they knew was the same person, and that connected. That's what the Apostle Paul was doing in Thessalonica. He was saying, you've heard about the Messiah. You know you're waiting for somebody. You've heard about Jesus. They're the same. This Jesus whom I proclaim to you is the Christ. Our goal when we're talking about Christianity, when people ask us what we believe, when we talk about faith, is simply to explain who Jesus is, to talk about his identity, to help people to see that Jesus is the Savior they know they need. When we do that, though, it's really unpredictable how that's going to play out. Because Jesus is a lot of things, but one thing he is not is a safe topic. As soon as you say the name of Jesus, as soon as you bring him into the discussion, who knows how people are going to react? It's a whole lot easier to talk about Christianity, to talk about church, to talk about faith, than it is to talk about Jesus. That gets a reaction. You don't know how people will respond. So the question for us is, are we faithful to wade into that uncertainty? To go where we don't know where things will lead? Are we faithful to explain Jesus? See, people in our culture are not that different from the first century Jews. They know they need help. They don't have scriptures necessarily that tell that to them, but we know that life isn't what we want it to be. So we watch TED Talks, and we read books, and we go to movies, and we talk to friends, and we read online forums, and we do all sorts of things to try and figure out, how do I fix the problems in my life? I know I need help. I know I'm broken. I know things aren't going well. And people in our culture have heard of this guy, Jesus. They know about him, and they know that some people think he's important, and some people think he's still alive, and he died, and he rose again, and the people that seem to like him are really weird, and I'm not sure I ever want to be around them. And they know about this Jesus guy. They just don't think that Jesus addresses their problems. And so as we present our faith to people, that's all we do. So we say, those things that you know you need, that's what Jesus offers. It's a simple message about the identity of Jesus of Nazareth. We help people to see that the needs they have are met by Jesus. Purpose, forgiveness, meaning, belonging, hope, love, connection. All those things that people will say, yeah, I want those. I just don't know if Jesus gives them to me. It's easy when we're talking about faith to get sidetracked on all the side issues, all those other things that come up. But But it's helpful to remember that the gospel isn't about same-sex marriage. The gospel isn't about who you vote for. The gospel isn't about the identity of Adam and Eve, or whether the earth was created in 6 days, or what happened in the church hundreds of years ago, or the weird Christian that I knew that used to live next door. The gospel is about Jesus of Nazareth. This Jesus, whom we proclaim, is the Christ. That's how Paul and his companions began their message. And as is the case, when you talk that way, the results are mixed. The responses are going to be varied. In verse 4, we hear about some people who responded positively to this message. It reads, "Some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks and not a few of the leading women." So here we have three different categories of people mentioned. Starts off by saying some of them, that would be the Jews in the synagogue, were persuaded. These are people that were Jewish, attended synagogue, but they were apparently the smallest portion of people that responded. Only some of them were persuaded. And then we hear about the devout Greeks. These are people that would have been God-fearers, Gentiles, who were somewhat attracted to the things about the Jewish God, but not so much that they wanted to become Jewish. So they hung around the synagogue, and when they heard Paul, they said, "Yes, that's what I want." The third category refers to leading women, probably wealthy merchant women in the community, probably Gentiles that then came to faith in Jesus. So Paul was preaching from the Old Testament, from the Jewish scriptures, saying these scriptures predict a Messiah that lines up with Jesus. But the people that responded, by and large, were Gentiles, devout Greeks, leading women. And Paul, I think, had started to get used to this by now, but in general, it surprised him that it was the Gentiles that responded to the message of Jesus, more so than the Jews even. And this helps us to realize that the gospel of Jesus Christ collects people in a surprising way. It assembles a group of people that are not necessarily the group of people you would expect to be assembled, not the ones you would predict, and perhaps not the ones you would choose to be assembled. But you never know who's attracted to this message of the gospel. It's one of the challenging things about being faithful in the midst of uncertainty. We have expectations. We go into things thinking, if I do this, then that will result. And so we do this, and if something else happens, we're not sure what to make of it. We're surprised. And sometimes we even miss it because we're not even looking over there because we don't expect this thing over here to happen. We're looking for this other group of people to respond or this other type of consequence. But we need to be willing to see what God is doing and not only see what we think he ought to be doing. See, we sow seeds in various places, and some of them will flower and grow, and some of them won't. But if we're looking here, we might miss this gorgeous plant that's growing out of the seeds we've sown. I sometimes talk about this as following the fruit. We need to pay attention to the fruit of our efforts to see what fruit God is generating and be willing to adapt and pay attention to it. Are we faithful to follow the fruit? It's one of the most remarkable aspects of the ministry of the early apostles that they were constantly changing their approach to things. They would go into a place and they would try one thing, and then they would try another. Even on this journey, Paul said, "Let's go do this," and that didn't work, so they tried to travel in a region, and that didn't work, so then they received a vision, and they said, "Okay, it's all about Macedonia. Let's go there." This ability to see what God is doing and to change and adapt, to pay attention to it, to focus our efforts there, that's what we need to cultivate. I was surprised by this when I was working in software development. There were some people that I enjoyed being around, and I went to lunch with and connected with and had fun with, and I thought, these are the people, you know, that surely my life of faith is going to rub off on them. And won't that be fun for them to become believers too? And then this other guy, one of my other colleagues, whom wasn't necessarily the person I would choose, said, "Hey, I know you're a Christian. Could we have lunch sometime to talk about that?" And I said, "You? Oh, okay. Let's do that. Let's have lunch." But it wasn't what I expected. I thought this is where God would give fruit, and yet it was over here. And so you have to change course and say, all right, let's go there. Let's see what God's doing over there. I think it's an important lesson for us to keep in mind now as a church. We're in a season of a lot of change. We've got people that have been around a while that are stepping down. We've got new people coming up. We're thinking about a major renovation project. And so there's all this change going on. I mean, we've got new pew cards even. Like, everything's changing, right? And we have to remember that what we think God might be doing maybe isn't what he's doing. Maybe we're looking for him to do this and he's going to do that. Or this other thing. And the challenge is to keep our eyes open. Pay attention to what God's doing and be willing to adapt to it. Sometimes when you preach, God teaches you the very thing that he's asking you to tell others. So this has actually been on my mind a lot this week. It's actually been a challenging week. I've been especially burdened by this sense of uncertainty of where things are going, of how they ought to go, of what is God actually doing. And I've been returning to this idea, letting go of my expectations, trying to say, God, what is it that you're doing? And how can we as a church focus our efforts there and pay attention and be faithful in that area? When things are uncertain, do we recognize where God is working, or are we looking in the wrong places? Well, sometimes we don't see what God's doing because we're looking somewhere else, but sometimes we don't see the positive stuff because it's mixed with so much negative stuff. That could have been what happened in Thessalonica. As the story continues, there's this group of people that responded, but the overwhelming response to the message of Paul and his companions was opposition. It's recorded in verses 5, and I'll read through 8. But the Jews were jealous, and taking some wicked men of the rabble, they formed a mob, set the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason, seeking to bring them out to the crowd. And when they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brothers before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have turned the world upside down have come here also, and Jason has received them. And they are all acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus." And the people and the city authorities were disturbed when they heard these things. The Jews were jealous. Paul had managed to convince some of these Jews that their scriptures talked about Jesus. And the ones that weren't convinced were angry that he would try to do such a thing. So they gathered all the people in the city that were kind of always up for a fight and said, "Let's go get these guys." Surrounded the house of Jason where they thought Paul was staying, banged on the door looking for him. He wasn't there, so they dragged someone else out instead. And this scene bears a striking resemblance to an earlier scene in the Old Testament. Some of you may know the story of Sodom, where angels visited a city, and the individual of Lot said, "Hey, come stay in my house." So the angels became his guests, but the city heard about them, and they got into an uproar. They formed a mob. They surrounded Lot's house, banged on his door, and said, "Send us out those men because we plan violence against them." And that story of Sodom became the paradigm of evil in the Old Testament. That the city of Sodom became a symbol for all that could go wrong when you turned against God. And now you have the gospel of Jesus Christ being preached in Thessalonica, and how do they respond? The same way that the people in Sodom responded. This is about as bad as it gets. And the really powerful thing they say here in verse 6 is, "These men have turned the world upside down." That's why they're in such of an uproar, why they're so upset, why they're so angry. They sense that their whole way of doing life, everything they understand about the world, has been shifted. See, the message of Christ was having an impact around the world. That's why the mob was so easy to form. It's likely that the Jews had recently been expelled from Rome because of the message of Jesus. People had heard of him, and they'd heard that his message was dangerous and challenging to the ways of living the good life in Roman society. The message of Jesus was turning the world upside down. In 2010, the Israel Museum, located in Jerusalem, was undergoing a major renovation. And as part of that, they said, hey, it'd be really nice to have a big sculpture right out as you walk into our building. So they commissioned this Indian artist named Anish Kapoor, and he built a 16-foot steel hourglass polished sculpture and named it Turning the World Upside Down, Jerusalem. Here's a picture of it. When you stand in front of this sculpture, you see the world around you flipped. What's up is down, what's down is up, all of that stuff. And I just think there's something, I don't know if it's ironic or God at work in some curious way, that this statue, turning the world upside down, is there in Jerusalem, the place where Jesus of Nazareth was killed and rose, the place where his message began to turn the world upside down. It's said that the sculpture is supposed to be a reference to the city's duality of heavenly and earthly, holy and profane. Paul and his companions faced opposition because their message did this. It shook everything up. It turned the world upside down. The question I want us to consider is whether our message does that. Do we talk about Jesus in a way that turns the world upside down or just tilt it a little bit? Just kind of a tweak on normal life. The true message of Jesus changes everything. It challenges the normal things of life. Are we willing to do that? Are we faithful to challenge the norm? I think sometimes we're not. We settle for a gospel that doesn't turn everything upside down, it just angles it slightly. We think that we can still worship education. We can still chase money. We can still hurt people in order to get ahead. We can still neglect our families and pressure our kids and obsess over our status. We can just keep doing all those things but add Jesus to it. Go to church, attend a Bible study, lead a thing or two. But life basically works the same way as it works for everybody else. But the gospel of Jesus Christ challenges everything about life. Maybe it'd be better to say that the world is already upside down, and the gospel of Jesus sets it right side up. That's probably theologically speaking a better perspective. That the world is broken. It doesn't work the way it ought, but the message of Jesus fixes it. Problem is, if you're used to living upside down, if you've only known up is down and down is up, then when somebody says, actually, you've got it backwards, you're not immediately thankful. You want to fight back. No, this is the way life's always worked. This is the way it ought to be. But the gospel doesn't just challenge the norm. It doesn't just break those old ideas. It fixes things. It restores. The gospel of Jesus enables us to live as we were meant to live. It restores our humanity, recreates our dignity, gives us purpose, redeems our desires, heals our wounds, creates a loving community. The world is upside down, looking for all those things. Jesus sets it right side up. But that message is opposed by those who are used to living upside down. That's what Paul and his companions experienced. And the same thing is happening in our day. It's why 21 Christian Egyptian men were beheaded in Libya recently. It's why mobs are burning churches in Niger. One of our missionaries is there to witness it. It's why we had to cancel our short-term trip to India this year, out of fear for the danger that such a trip might put us or our partners in India in. This kind of violence is here in our world today. Now, we don't experience a lot of that kind of violence here, but our brothers and sisters do. And we experience, maybe not violence, but we do experience the cost of living in a world right side up that's trying to be upside down. Because if you stop worshiping education, your kids might not go to the best school. If you stop worshiping achievement, you might not accomplish as much as you would otherwise. You might not be as respected by your peers or your colleagues. If you stop chasing money, you might not drive the car you would otherwise drive or live where you might want to live. If you really allow God to turn your life right side up, you might miss out on some of the upside down values that our culture worships. This is where the books of 1st and Thessalonians are going to help us. Because they're written to people trying to figure out, what does it mean to live between these times? What does it mean to make decisions here? How do I figure out how to live right side up in an upside down world? How do I challenge the norm even when it costs me in my life? A big part of the trick of living in between times is responding to uncertainty. What we've seen in Thessalonica is Paul and his companions go in, they preach a message. Some people respond, some people don't. And then there's this kind of uproar against them, but what ends up happening? In the previous city, Philippi, I mentioned that they got thrown in prison, there was this earthquake, God showed up in miraculous ways, delivered them, the message of Jesus went forth, but things play out differently in Thessalonica. Here's verses 9 and 10. And when they, that is the city officials, when they had taken money as security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. The brothers immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea, and when they arrived, they went into the Jewish synagogue. So in the previous city, God showed up. There's an earthquake. Jailers were throwing themselves down on the ground in worship of Jesus. And in Thessalonica, Jason posted bail, and they left at night. It's a bit of an anticlimax, right? I mean, why doesn't God do something bigger here? Why doesn't the mob change their mind and worship Jesus? Why doesn't God show up and reveal himself to them? What do we do with the fact that it's just a fine and they flee? I think this is why Paul didn't know how things were going to work in Thessalonica. When Paul wrote his letter to the Philippians, he was confident that what had begun there was going to continue. He said this in Philippians 1, verse 6. I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. He had seen God do something huge in Philippi. But when he wrote to the Thessalonians, he said this, chapter 3, verse 5. For this reason, when I could bear it no longer, I sent to learn about your faith, for fear that somehow the tempter had tempted you and our labor would be in vain. See, the everyday normal response that happened in Thessalonica made Paul wonder, was my labor in vain? Is anything good really going to come of this? And I think that's one of the challenges that we face living in between. How do we move forward with uncertainty? How do we believe in a transcendent God when our lives are so ordinary? When most of what we do, most of what we experience is just the normal stuff of life. How do we keep faithful in the commonplace? Are we faithful in the everyday? Sometimes God works in miraculous ways. Sometimes he reveals himself to us. Sometimes he changes our mind. We make life-changing decisions. We see people healed and lives transformed, and we see these amazing things of God at work in the world. And sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes going to church is boring. And sometimes your Bible study doesn't make sense. And sometimes your community group forgets that it's your birthday. And they don't notice that you haven't been there for 4 weeks. And sometimes Christians are mean, and they make fun of you. And sometimes life is just ordinary and common. And where is God in that? Where is God in the daily rhythm? It's easy when there's earthquakes and jailers worshiping Jesus. But what about when you just pay a fine and slip off? Can you be faithful in those circumstances too? We have to avoid getting complacent. We have to avoid letting the regular rhythm lull us into just ignoring or discounting or forgetting about God. It's those everyday things that have meaning, that form the rhythm of our faith. The outcome of our efforts are uncertain, but God is sure. So now, when I buy a pair of shoes from REI, I am confident. I know that no matter what my 10-year-old boys do to those shoes, my money was well spent. My satisfaction is guaranteed. But as we know, most of life doesn't work that way. Most of life is uncertain. I don't know what's going to come of my efforts as a friend, as a husband, as a father, as a pastor, as a neighbor. I don't know whether my labor will be in vain. I don't know what results God might or might not bring from the energies that I spend. But I know that he's asked me to be faithful, to keep at it, to listen to him, to follow where he leads, to be courageous and take risks, and trust that he's in charge of the results. He's asked me to be faithful, to focus on Jesus, to know that Jesus is the center of what I believe. It's all about the identity of Jesus. Faithful to know that he's going to do things differently than I might do them. And I need to pay attention to where he's working and follow that fruit. Be willing to adapt and change and restructure and go where he's asking me to go, not where I think he should ask me to go. I need to be faithful to challenge the norms of the culture I live in, to be different, to cost myself or my family, to not succeed or win in the same way that others in my community might be. And I need to be faithful to do these things in a consistent, everyday, normal, commonplace manner. God doesn't guarantee that any of that faithfulness is going to go anywhere. He doesn't promise me what's going to come of it. He doesn't tell me whether anyone will respond. But he gives me something more. God says, in all of that, I am with you. He gives us his presence. He says he loves us, that he is with us. He sends his spirit both in us as individuals and to fill us as a community. And his spirit connects us and reminds us of him. He tells us that Jesus has walked those paths that we are being asked to walk, and Jesus will walk them with us as well. In our faithfulness, God is with us. We connect with him. We find him there. These letters were written to a church with uncertain beginnings, trying to help them figure out how to live life in the here and now. They deal with a lot of different areas of life. We're going to talk about what kind of lives we ought to live. We'll talk about how we live out our sexuality as we follow Jesus, about the future return of Jesus. We'll talk about ambition and grief and working hard at our jobs and devotion to God. We'll see these letters give practical guidance for life in between and what it looks like to follow Jesus. And the clear message throughout them is that Jesus is here. He is with us in that. Even when things were uncertain in the city of Thessalonica, God was at work, even in the normal stuff. And because of that, a church grew there, and Paul was thrilled to hear about the strength of their faith. Even as he's writing to them, he's telling them, Jesus will be with you. He is coming back. He will be present with you, so that you can be faithful. And for us living here in the Silicon Valley in the 21st century, Jesus is still with us, guiding and connecting and empowering us. Life is uncertain, but Jesus is sure. May we continue to place our hope in him. Amen.